Well, hello everyone, and as promised yesterday, there's still all this cigar to go of the Upman Connoisseur B, and that means that we're going to be covering round two of David Starkey versus Conor Tomlinson. We got 40 minutes through the first time round, and a lot of people wanted round two, and for whatever reason, I got distracted, other things came up, I never got it done. I thought, well, while I was sitting here enjoying the cigar, why not clear some of my desk away, clear away some of the work I had to do in the spirit of abundance. You got to give to receive, and you got to receive to give. Does that work? No, you got to give to receive. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. Now, before we get going here, I would recommend you pick up some courses from the academic agency. Bank holiday coming up, perfect time to do it, or you can do it over the summer, or do it in your evenings after work. You won't regret taking, I've yet to meet a single person who's taken Trivium who's regretted taking it, because you need those skills all the time. And it's a very good time to pick up the Trivium right now, and in fact any of my courses, because there's a sale on. The first sale since all the way back at the start of January is the last time I had a sale. It's promo code COOL, and I've got a brand new advert to ship it. Everybody wants to be cool. Like this guy. This guy is cool. Do you know who else is cool? People who do courses at the academic agency. And you too can be cool by getting a course today with promo code COOL, which gets you 25% off all courses. Today. Promo code COOL. I'm still amused by it. We'll be sick of it in a few weeks, but while it's still new, I'm still kind of I dig that guy. He's cool. All right. Yeah, promo code COOL. Nice and easy to remember. Okay, so we're going to pick up where we left off with Starkey going on. They started talking about religion. So let's see where this goes.
Do the political system. But
I should have mentioned, not that anybody's going to care. Beautiful cigar. I had a fantastic Upman Sir Winston on Deepest Law, which is one of the best cigars of my entire life. This one, I have to say, is, that one was a 98. This one's at least batting a 94. It's got that beautiful buttery it's a buttery croissant shortbread with hints of cinnamon. Beautiful Upman DNA. Lovely complexity. It's been aged a couple of years, this one as well. All right, let's carry on.
So much prison reform, so much social reform, the entire activities, many of which I actually deeply disapprove of the Joseph Rowntree Trust, driven by this very, very odd and eccentric religion, which of course is anti-Trinitarian, rejects many of the central doctrines, certainly of the Catholic Church and indeed any church with a formed clergy. But I think it was that what happened, the reason you're able to accommodate Jews and so on, is because finally you acknowledge religion as centrally a private matter. That's the, in other words, it's a matter of choice. Now, it seems to me that you could imagine, if you had a confident state, Islam in the West being shifted decisively in that direction. I'm just asking you to imagine it. I think it's possible, and I think in the circumstances where we are now, that would be desirable. But of course, we would both agree it would require a confidence of the state and a deployment of legal machinery unlike anything that we've seen for a century or more in this country.
Yes, I don't think it would be desirable. I want to go back there. The principle of confining religion to the, let's say, private sphere, is is based on the biblical injunction, you know, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar and render unto God that which is God's. That injunction isn't found in Islam, where you have the Shias and the Sunnis squabbling not over whether or not there should be a caliphate, an all-encompassing religious authority, but just who gets to lead it, whether or not it's some sort of divinely appointed political figure or a reincarnated descendant of Muhammad's who was robbed of the ability to do so in the 8th century or whatever.
No, I don't really want to get into my least favorite topic in the entire world, which is theology. But in my understanding, the church always had some, or Christianity in general, always had this idea of the city of God and the city of heaven, or the city of man. Sorry, the city of man and the city of God. Is that the two swords of Augustine? Is that right, Saint Augustine? I remember for my book, Shakespeare's Moral Compass, going into some depth about that, and in fact in Prophets of Doom I talk about it as well. My understanding is that the church was for spiritual matters, whereas the throne was for matters of man, and that these two things, for various different reasons, kept to their own domains, which is why you end up with the emperor and with the pope. The throne and the altar. But then there have been people at different times who have argued for bringing those two things together, who argue that they're better off as one. One of those people, by the way, is Julius Evola, who said that in the Golden Age, you had the solar king, who was both, both a religious spiritual figure as well as a warrior, and he combined both of those, and that then you get a degeneration from that into the Silver Age, where the ruling class is only priest, and then a degeneration from that again, where the warriors get fed up with the priests and kill them all, and then in the Bronze Age, you get a warrior caste who are not spiritually enlightened. But the ideal is to have a warrior caste who is spiritual, who actually is a king who embodies both in himself. And so Evola is always trying to get back to that. So he doesn't like separation. He sees and when it's between the emperor and the pope, he tends to end up siding it with the emperor. I'm interested to know where Connor goes with this, but there are different opinions available when it comes to this.
I don't think you're going to get that with Islam, and I also don't think that there is necessarily such a thing as a public-private distinction. But Gwaine Taylor wrote about this recently for Reform, saying there should be Anglican Jews, Anglican Muslims, Anglican Sikhs, feeling their faith personally and devoutly, but compartmentalizing it away from the public sphere. And it's like, I'm sorry, but if you think that all of your, if you think your metaphysical convictions, your belief in what is good and evil, death and the afterlife, justice, judgment, punishment, if you think all of those can be compartmentalized away from your public activity, you're almost conceiving of your house as like a magic portal for which you step through and it doesn't have any bearing on your public conduct. And I just don't think that's the case. And
this is something I find very interesting, because again, I'm going to have to try to make a I'm known for saying value free a lot, but this is where my personal views and my personal life and beliefs and so on have to converge from the value free analysis, because temperamentally I kind of agree with Starkey that it should be a private affair. I tend to agree with that myself. But realistically, looking at it through an objective lens, this leads to a situation where there's nothing to defend the faith in public. And then you end up with people who don't believe that trampling over it. I'll tell you, I remember listening to an LBC call-in a couple of months back where this Muslim chap called in to Sheila Fogarty. And Sheila Fogarty said that she was born and raised a Catholic. I may have mentioned this on the previous time, on the previous stream, but it's been long enough ago that you've probably forgotten it by now. You may have not watched that. And this Muslim guy, so Sheila Fogarty was trying to defend the principle that anybody should be able to just make fun of your God or your religion or of Jesus or of Muhammad, and that you should have like enough strength in your faith to just laugh. And she was saying like she remembers growing up and watching Monty Python's Life of Brian and Dave Allen, who was a comedian who made a lot of religious jokes and things like that, and thinking that those were hilarious and that is the correct liberal spirit. And I was thinking, yeah, but Sheila, you can draw a straight line from that Monty Python film or from Dave Allen making fun of the church or making fun of priests and whatnot, making fun of religion in general and the decline of the church. You can basically say, well, it was the church stronger before Monty Python and Dave Allen or afterwards. And objectively speaking, it's gone down. Church attendance has gone down. Religious belief in the country has gone down because there were no public figures willing to stand up for it. And because the religion became fair game to be made fun of by comedians. And the Muslim chap was trying to make the argument that actually, you know, because what he was trying to argue, I can't remember what the inciting incident was for this, but he was trying to say, like, look, I don't agree. As a Muslim, I don't agree with that. You have a go of my faith and there should be consequences for you because this is just like the most important thing to me. So if we're not going to defend it, if we do not have something that's sacred, that we're not willing to defend it, and it's just fair game, you know, it's actually good that you're a little bit scared to have a go at it because it's sacred. It's sacred to us. And if we don't take it seriously, who else is going to take it seriously? So everybody has to take it seriously because this is like, you know, this is my faith. And Sheila Fogarty was saying, well, as a kind of liberal Catholic, I don't really agree with that. Dave Allen, Monty Python. And I through that conversation, I understood where Sheila Fogarty was coming from. I grew up in that Britain. I watched Dave Allen when I was a kid. I watched Monty Python when I was a kid. Okay, I'm a default liberal, as everybody is in this society. And I was just thinking, well, yeah, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, people have treated Christianity as a joke and the church has gone down. And the Muslims have stood up for their religion and people are scared to criticize Muhammad. And so that their faith is stronger for it as an objective fact. So, you know, I mean, temperamentally, I kind of agree with David Starkey and I agree with Sheila Fogarty, right? This is a de facto liberal position and that's how I was raised and, you know, the Britain I grew up in. But objectively speaking, stepping out of myself, stepping out of my own beliefs and practices or whatnot, I think, well, yeah, but that hasn't been good for the church. Maybe the church shouldn't have been such a walkover. Maybe there should have been more pushback against Dave Allen and Monty Python and so on. Anyway, I don't know. You understand what I'm saying, though, right? Let's see where Connor takes this.
I think also there is a vacuum in politics that will then be filled by other agendas. I think this is where ideology has rushed in. Socialism, you know, from the 19th and 20th centuries, has preyed upon the Christian feeling of our country. I think Tom Holland's quite good on this, of compassion for the weak, and has taken that and runaway fashion has now found its apotheosis in some part of the Green Party, where they want to abolish our borders and have unlimited welfare and not stigmatise various lifestyle choices or drug use. And also, I will say, and this is perhaps very contentious, David, I think when I say some Jews, I mean some Jews. There have been, ever since Cromwell brought them back, there have been Jews in Britain for the last few hundred years. But clearly, judging by foreign policy debates since the atrocities of October the 7th, the interests of Jews as a people whether or not it's religious, but it certainly is sort of tribal, ethnic, and religious. It's all sort of bound up together in an old world manner. It clearly has a bearing on our politics, and it has a bearing in such a way that not just Christianity, but English peoplehood does not. And you have people who, like, whether it's Danny Finkelstein from the Conservatives or Barbara Roach from Labour, who say that we have to have certain immigration laws because the Jews were persecuted in the 20th century, and therefore every Albanian and his son who doesn't like foreign chicken nuggets is exactly the same, and so we have to keep the ECHR on the books. So because of this intractable religious and ethnic identity, we have to live under a certain set of laws. And I'm sorry, if that's possible, I think if we have to.
And again, I mean, in the interests of value free again, remember I was saying that Muslim guy wanted to stand up for his faith and say, like, well, there has to be consequences if people are scared to have a go at Muhammad. Okay. Now, I may not, as a non-Muslim, I may not like that. But also, I've seen, oh, shit, if somebody makes fun of Muhammad, they get their head kicked in, or worse happens to them. By the same token, the group that Connor's talking about there, and again, this is value-free, okay, regardless of my own personal feelings on it, they also make sure there are consequences of going, like, there are constant, you know, acting in a group interest, there are consequences for having a go at their faith or having a go at their people and so on and so forth. And that has made itself felt as well. So I guess I wonder if where Connor's going with this, why is it that every other group, whether it's Muslims or in this case Jews, get to play this game, but the native Brits don't get to play this game? How sustainable is it that every other group gets to play this game, but the native Brits don't? I think that's where Connor's going with this. And I would say that if you view it through the lens of equality and fairness, it would be difficult to see how Starkey's going to come back on this without some sort of special pleading. Let's see.
Refocus our politics around protecting religious minorities. Or if we have to protect the ability for Israel to exist as a nation by and for Jewish people, then why can't we refocus our politics around our history, our tradition, our Christian faith, and our identity? Like, why can't we just have what Israel has, but for England? And if you were to go to Israel and say, well, you have to have your Arab population have some sort of, like, equal representation in the state. It's not just that you have to accommodate them in the Knesset and you give them some seats and have a quarter of Jerusalem, which you don't really want to give up to them, but you have to have them there to keep the peace. You have to have your state secularized to basically accommodate them. They would laugh in your face, and I think they would be quite right to do so.
So Connor's going back to one of his favorite hobby horses, which is why can't we have here what they've got in Israel? And I've said before, and I've told Connor this in DMs and stuff, so he knows my view, I don't actually think it's desirable to want to have an Israel here. Okay? Because, I mean, it's hard for me to look at Israel and be like, oh, well, I want that here. You know, they're at war with eight different people at the same time. They have to live with people who are trying to kill them all the time. You know, least popular country on earth for various different reasons. And, you know, they've engaged in behavior that I can't condone, you know, with a good moral conscience. So I find it, like, rhetorically strange to look at that and say, well, I want that here. So I disagree with it as a kind of rhetorical strategy, but I know where he's going. I think a different way of phrasing this would have been the way I put it, which is like, every other group gets to do this. Why don't we get to do it? Anyway, let's see what Starkey says, because I've got a funny feeling we're going to see some special pleading coming up here.
And so I don't think we should do that. I don't think it's desirable to actually accommodate Islam. I don't think we should try to imagine that. I think we should just work to get rid of it.
I think that is an answer which is a very 17th century answer in terms of our history, which would have got rid of you. I'm being very serious. I mean, if one looks at the record of ultramontane Catholicism.
What he means is they would have got rid of Catholics in the high, in the Reformation era.
Catholicism and the murder of rulers. It's at least as effective as that of Islam in recent years. The use of mass terrorism, St. Bartholomew, and whatever. It's all there.
David, but
all... Please.
Yeah.
Just let me make the point. And nevertheless, this extremely dangerous, and it was extremely dangerous. Look at the destabilization of France in the 16th century. This extremely dangerous ultramontane religion, claiming the authority of unintermediated God over politics, which is exactly what the worst types of Islam do, and is exemplified, of course, by the theocratic regime in Iran. I'm giving you a different vision. I'm saying that what happened to religion in Britain...
And I will just say, in the interest of balance and fairness, my dad is from Iran. I've spent my entire life, as I've mentioned many times to you, hearing from people like my dad and other people from Iran who've left that country who absolutely hated living under the theocracy. My dad is not a religious man, not into Islam and stuff like that. And he found it to be an intolerable pain to live under that. He didn't leave for that reason. He left because he was married to my mother and because of the, they were together when the revolution happened, and she was white and blonde and couldn't live there, and so on, right? So maybe there's a version of his life where he could have stayed there, but I know that he's told me stories that he found it, he's quite a free spirit, he's quite an adventuring guy, he used to work on ships and all the rest of it as a chief engineer, and he just couldn't stand living under a theocracy. Just couldn't stand it. The interference, he was a very good engineer, but he's going up for a job. By any rights, he should get the promotion, but he doesn't do, he doesn't say his prayers five times a day, and maybe he went out drinking, and some dude called literally Muhammad didn't like that, and all the rest of it. And it's just imagine having to put up with all of that all the time. So I understand where this view that Starkey is coming from. Okay, my dad unquestionably has got on better in life and has had a better life growing up here. He's been here since he was a teenager, since he was 16, 17. He's had a better time of it growing up here, like making his career here, than he would have done if he'd stayed in the Iranian merchant navy. That's just a fact. And why? Because he found the theocratic rules got in the way and were bullshit for him. It's like, what's God got to do? Like, what's Ali or Muhammad or anything else got to do with whether this machine is going to be fixed or not? Or what? Or how good a job you're doing or whatever else? So from that point of view, I can understand that. And probably David Starkey's thinking in the back of his head, if you go back to those times, a man like me who's gay, he'd probably be stoned. And it's like, And it's like, this is the thing. In rightoidal art world, some people would be saying, well, good. It should be like that. But realistically, do you really want to live in that society where a man like David Starkey, who's a great historian, who's an interesting and clever guy, is precluded from having a career because he's gay, and this is why I've always maintained the postmodern part of postmodern traditionalism. There are some things that we like, they're not going to go back in that sense, and then we have to say, well, even if we could put it back, is it desirable, or are there actually aspects of the kind of settlement that we've arrived at in Western countries that do work for the betterment of everyone? don't know whether it's my father's engineering skills or Starkey as a historian or something like that. You know, it's kind of silly to say, well, you didn't say the right prayers, or his sexuality is wrong, therefore, you know, he should be precluded from having a job. You know, so I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know about that. But anyway, let's carry on.
Was from directly by Henry VIII, and then with the shifting politics of the 17th century, it was subject to what was called Erastianism. It was made to serve the interests of the state, which by definition puts it semi into the private sphere until it's finally fully shifted there. So you even all that's left of the...
And there's another problem as well, and this is a problem that Arnold Toynbee talks about. I discuss it in Prophets of Doom. Prophets of Doom, somewhat misunderstood book, I think, but there's Arnold Toynbee with his little cup of tea there. And one of the things that Toynbee talks about is what happens when the spiritual institution becomes a temporal institution and it atrophies, right? Something that is meant to be spiritual atrophies into being of this world. City of God devolves into the city of man, if you want to put it in those terms. So now you have the temporal institution, and the thing that is meant to be geared towards spiritual transcendence, what Evelyn and all those other dudes talk about, spiritual transcendence, the divine, the great work, whichever way you want to put it, the absolute, the eternal yea that Carlyle talks about. What happens when it atrophies into being a mundane political institution? And again, you can look at the theocracy in Iran and you can say, well, did the Ayatollahs, did the mullahs succeed in making Iran, stripping Iran of degeneracy? Did it stop young people taking drugs? Did it stop young people engaging in, you know, sexual behaviors or watching porn or any of the things that you'd think a theocratic state would be able to achieve? And the fact is, it didn't do any of that. They failed in that central mission from a moral point of view. And did they succeed in making Iran a more spiritually, you know, a country that looks upwards in that Avonian sense? And the fact of the matter is that young people in their droves turned away from Islam because they found the system that the Ayatollah had set up to be oppressive. They found it to be intolerable, like my dad did. And now my dad is basically almost like a Reddit tier atheist, which is presumably the opposite intention that the Ayatollah would have had in the first place. So I understand why Starkey has the concerns he has about this. But anyway, let's carry on. All of this stuff I'm saying is in a neutral capacity here. I'm, as with the other one, I'm trying to be fair to both sides. And, you know, when Connor watches this, maybe he'll take some of the things I said on board or, you know, give him something else to think about type thing. But, you know, because it seems like Connor is trying to drive towards something like this here. And, you know, he's going to get, I mean, if he then push back off Starkey, you know, you wait until you get to Zach Polanski or someone like this, you know, or, you know, I mean, Keir Starmer, or, you know, that they would, or the left. Right, this is a rightist we're talking about here with Starkey. I mean, imagine when you get to some of those people, the level of pushback you'll get. Richard Dawkins, say. So anyway, let's carry on.
The established church is a kind of shell, a shell of public ritual, the thing that I call English Shinto. Now, it does seem to me that it would be possible to do something like this to Islam. In other words, the ultramontane Catholicism did not recognize Christ's distinction between that which is Caesar's and that which is God's. It claimed on earth a direct imposition of God's superiority, exactly as Islam does. And it was broken, particularly in Britain, by the force of the secular state. And what I'm suggesting is this would be an extremely effective way of handling what we both agree is a profoundly intractable problem. But of course, all of these things don't compete on the same field. And this.
So David Starkey wants to use the British state to break Islam in the same way that it broke this fundamentalist form of Christianity. So he'd get pushback for that as well from the Muslims themselves. I'd like to see that attempted and to see how they do that. But from a certain point of view, that he's right, in so much as it has worked before. In this case, with the kind of fundamentalist form of Christianity, you know, therefore it could work again. And there is some evidence in some Muslim communities that it has, like essentially where you've made a kind of, a secular, broken kind of Muslim community that conforms to British norms and all the rest of it. You know, it has worked to some extent, but Islam has still got quite a lot of antibodies, as per that caller to Sheila Fogarty. So this is an interesting suggestion from Starkey, but, whether it's realistic or not, I don't know. Let's see what Connor says.
Again, and we'll conclude on this, I think. And in other words, I'm not saying let's stop now, but the very question of identity, this vexed thing that we've been that everybody has been talking round, waltzing round, nibbling round. Do you actually think that there is such a thing as a British nation?
Well, there's certainly the construct in terms of the union of England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland. But in terms of, if we're speaking about nations as in peoples, which is the traditional definition, then you would say, yeah, the Anglo-Celtic peoples, which is why our colonies reliably produce the same results. And even though there's a bit of ethnic tension and banter between the various regions, they're more cohesive than most other nations we would describe as nations. I mean, Hungary describes itself as, upwards of 85% Magyar, and they've had mass population exchanges because they're a landlocked European country, whereas, we have genetic continuity upwards of 90% between, 927 and 1927. As you've even quoted on your show before, David, we had less immigration between 1066 and the Second World War since Tony Blair. No wonder he abolished the penalty of hanging for treason. I'd rewind very briefly, but I think it's bound up in this. In the countries that you cite, I understand that Britain has been uniquely successful in its endeavours to, insofar as it exists, compartmentalise public and private among Christian denominations. But in the nations that you've cited where they've kept the more doctrinaire and violent elements of Islam under control, they're all Muslim nations. And so I would just suggest that what you're going to get if you try to keep accommodating Islam is a Muslim nation which keeps other denominations of Muslims in check and allows Christians and Jews and other minorities to live there as second-class citizens, rather than a secular...
I'm afraid I find this, the notion that the 6.5% Muslim population of this country, is it 6.5%? It's something like that. 5%, 6%. Could successfully turn Britain into a Muslim nation. I still think it's a fanciful idea that a lot of counter jihad types and Tommy types and so on repeat endlessly. I just don't think that's a realistic prospect in the future. I know lots of people disagree with that, but I just don't see the practically how that's going to happen, especially when the bulk of the population in Britain, as per Bowden, just has no interest in Islam whatsoever, let alone like converting or anything like that. How on earth is Islam going to convert the nation of Britain to be an Islamic state? Seems far-fetched, but maybe he can explain the mechanics of how that would work.
In a British state that keeps all religions sort of together. And so I don't think this is desirable. It's not desired by the majority of the public. It's not desired by a majority of Reform's own supporters. It's certainly not desired by Restore Britons. And I don't think we should have to accept that settlement if people don't want it. I think we should instead just sort of get rid of it. Anyway, continue down your line of questioning.
Yeah, thank you. What I'm trying to say is that there isn't such a thing as a British nation. You came up with this weird formula of Anglo-Celtic or whatever it was. Talk about a mouthful. The way Britain worked was that you had three nations the Celtic fringe, that primarily, until very recently, expressed their identities culturally, essentially by the apparatus of cultural nationhood of the 19th century. So Scott Watery, folk music, national dress, a national poet, all of that sort of stuff. Whereas the dominant nation, and it was the dominant nation, and it was acknowledged to be the dominant nation, so almost all of our politicians and almost all foreigners never refer to Britain as Britain. They just call it England. It is political.
This is true. How do I know? Because I'm a Welshman who's travelled in many parts of the world. And when I say I'm from Wales, I often get the answer, oh, that's in England. No, Wales is not in England. The level of understanding abroad of what Wales is, not all parts, some parts of the world they understand, but like Americans in particular, you're from, that's from England, isn't it? England. No, Wales. Nobody cares. Oh, thanks. We care. Anyway, let's carry on.
It is simply Greater England. And what all of what I would call, and I'm going to use the word deliberately, even to you, Connor, subordinate nations acknowledged the political superiority of England. In other words, Britain was a country where the dominant tone of public life and public discourse and public institutions were ethnically coherent because of the dominance of England, and indeed the overwhelming size of England in terms of its population, its wealth, and so on within the British Isles. And the catastrophe that's happened is the Britishification and the deliberate destruction of the idea of England and the loss of confidence of the English elites. And it's very easy.
Carl Benjamin would agree with that. As a kind of small little Englander, I've had many a drink with Carl in real life, and once he's had a couple, he will invariably start talking about what about the English, what about the English, what about the English. So there is something to what Starkey's saying here.
To see how it happens. As far as the and I'll use these very awkward terms, the lower classes, the working classes, whatever you call it, in England, the loss of identity is due to the fact that you completely get rid of a peasantry. If you actually look at the elements of what are normally regarded as ethnic identity, they're essentially the creatures of the countryside, the dress of the German peasant, the Italian food, or the La France profonde, all that sort of thing. Our extraordinarily advanced industrialization, urbanization, the complete transformation of land tenure into commercial tenure within the final enclosure movement and whatever, that despite all the very strong differences, or quite strong differences of accent, tradition, and whatever, that has an extraordinarily deracinating and levelling effect. And then,
he's right about this, because people were mixed up, people were scattered all about, mixed up, and had to move for work, and what Carlyle would call nomadism. There was a great, when urbanisation happened, there was huge internal migrations. So that English people ended up in Wales and Welsh people ended up in England and Scots ended up in, all over the place, and the English ended up in Scotland because people had to move for work. That's also a fact.
The other is the English elite, and indeed English, and remember, is both a victim of extraordinary success. That's to say, all things that are peculiarly English became universal possessions. The suit you're wearing is actually English national dress. People don't realize this. The days of the division of the week into the working week and the weekend is English. Sports, organized sport, is English. And the actual social division of the year, the season, is English. Horse racing is English. All of this sense has been forgotten because, of course, it's now universal. And then finally, of course, the way we dealt with it in the 19th century and the early 20th was as a top nation nationhood, a top nation nationalism. And of course, that's kicked out by the fact we ceased to be top nation. But surely, can't we call things by their proper names? It's not simply the ethnicity, though I think the fact that every successful nation, and you know the general view is that in so many nations are actually really quite diverse, but they will have a dominant ethnic group that sets the tone. I mean, Russia is another extreme example of that kind of thing. And
this is true in lots of places. You know, in Iran, of course, what people think of as Iranian culture is actually, you know, the top group there was Persia. It was, you know, it was called Persia for a long time. The dominant ruling class was Persia. Yesterday, I looked at Tucker Carlson and Buckley Carlson, and I talked about the WASPs. Well, historically, the top group there, the ruling class, were the New England WASPs. And that was one of the things that were thought of as being, quote-unquote, American, actually are the styles, trappings, thought patterns of that ruling class. So this is, in a sense, what you get in every nation. And again, sorry to shill Prophets of Doom again, but again, underrated English thinker and historian Arnold Toynbee. You can see him on the front there with his cup of tea next to another great Englishman, John Bagot Glubb. He talks about the creative minority. The creative minority, which is, I guess, his name for the elite class, but so much of the tempo is set by the creative minority. And perhaps one of the kind of hidden things that we're getting at here is that the makeup, the nature of that creative minority has changed quite radically since the end of the Second World War.
What I think we need to be talking about is this much more sensitive approach. So you recognize not multiculturalism, but what I would call biculturalism. So generally speaking, most Scots, at least until very recently, most Welsh until recently, were very much willing to acknowledge that overarching political identity, language, and whatever. Obviously, Ireland separated itself from that and with an acute division within Ireland and Irish politics. But this very diversity surely offers us a genuine chance of accommodating some of, by no means all, some of the diversity which has been foisted on us, and I agree completely it's been foisted, also recognizing that some of the groups have accommodated very well to what I would call this double identity, not a multiple identity, but to a double identity, and accept what I call the Erastian, accept the overarching quality of I call it Anglo-British, of an Anglo-British way of life, politics, and whatever. And wouldn't this be rather than?
So let's try to understand what Dr. Starkey is saying here in concrete terms. I think basically what he's talking about is the Rishi Sunak you know, well-spoken. Yes, he is of an Indian ethnic stock, but, you know, he's been to the right schools, he speaks in the right accent. You close your eyes and it's difficult to tell the difference between Tony Blair and Rishi Sunak. He likes a cup of tea like any other. He plays cricket, right, like every other, you could say like every other Indian, because they like tea and cricket there, but you understand what I'm trying to get at here. Or the Priti Patel, or is he getting toward Aura? Who's that guy on New Culture Forum? The guy who loves Churchill so much? You know, and one of my issues with this, and again, I don't have all the answers here, and it may sound like I'm all over the place because I'm just trying to give my honest reactions to points as they're coming up. One of the issues with this Anglo-Britishness idea is that it does lead to kind of what I would describe as an arid patriotism. I think a lot of what goes on at the New Culture Forum, unfortunately, atrophies into quite an, I mean, I've called it in the past, biscuit tin traditionalism. You know, Morgoth has used phrases like spitfire nationalism or bulldog nationalism. But this is ultimately where this idea ends up. And the thing I genuinely worry about is that, is it strong enough? Is it strong enough? Is wearing the right blazer, speaking with the right accent, drinking the right whiskey, taking milk with your tea, Henley Regatta, and all of those other intangibles that T.S. Eliot talks about in his famous essay on what constitutes Englishness. Are all of those things enough to hold a nation together, to animate patriotic feeling, to mask over the cracks of difference between ethnic groups? And it's possible that they are. What I suspect, and in my heart of heart I know and worry, that they may not be enough. And that's the big question that, you know, the Danny Krugers of this world and the Starkeys of this world are asking in a way. But they must have this worry at the back of their head that it may not be strong enough. You know, what's that guy's name? Rafe Kendall. I mean, okay, let's imagine an entire nation of Rafes. I mean, he's a good guy, he likes Churchill. Okay, I can agree to disagree on that. But, you know, he likes a good cigar, well-spoken, knows his history, has a good feeling towards the country. Would it still be Britain? Or is there, in the background of this, something performative and something, the word I would use is arid. And the thing I worry about is that so many of these forms, again, I hate to get all woo-woo and spiritual and Arnold Toynbee and Evola on everybody, but are these living traditions or are they dead traditions? Are they living or are they dead? And I don't know if I have an answer to that. You know, recently I took my daughter to Hever Castle because I wanted her to experience the traditional May Day. And there were guys walking around in crowns, actors playing the role of the king of the summer and the king of the spring. And, they did it in a really nice traditional way. But there was still in the back of my head, I was thinking, well, is this a living tradition or is it a living museum? Is this a real thing that's happening or are we performing some aspect of history? And I don't actually have the answer to that. I don't know if I experienced a genuine maypole there or not. I'm glad I did it. It was nice. It was good for my daughter to experience. But was it living tradition? I don't have the answer. I honestly don't know. And these are the sorts of, as somebody who cares deeply, these are the sorts of questions I ask. And I don't have the answer. Maybe you will have the answer. Would it be good if everybody went to the Maypole on May Day? Yeah, it would be. If you did it enough, would it become a living tradition again? Yeah, I think it would. But at the same time, I had the feeling, and I mean, it's what I'm always looking for is authenticity. You know, true child of the postmodern moment of the 90s, I'm always worried about authenticity. I'm trying to reach that authentic place. And in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking, is this just the simulacra of the thing? What does it really mean for anybody to kind of try to embody the trappings of how a gent would behave in the early 20th century? Or are you just cosplaying? I don't know. Anyway, let's see where this goes.
This, as it were, search for ethnic purity. Wouldn't this be a way which is both creative, effective, has the necessary feature of politics? And I'd be interested in whether you agree with me that it's a necessary feature of politics. Politics, finally, has to be the art of the possible, doesn't it? But
you see, the thing, I'm sorry to keep on interrupting Starkey here, but this is a really important point, because what is he really getting at, though? Is he talking about wearing the right suit and the right handkerchief in the right pocket, you know, and pronouncing your R's in a certain way and knowing the right things to say? I mean, this is just form. Is that what he's talking about? And if so, does that make a nation? Is that enough? Honestly, I couldn't tell you. I don't know.
It's not the absolute desirable, but we are very rarely able to choose simply between good and bad. We usually have to choose between, you know, okay, and, well, or it may be absolutely terrible. Do you know what I see? This spectrum. Am I not offering a way through?
You see, I have other kind of things that swim through my mind. For example, let's pretend you do get rid of all the foreigners in the entire country, like the Steve Law's dream. And now you're left with British people as they are right now, with all of the girls with their fish lips and, you know, bad Botox jobs and Yadino Van Man and all the rest of them. They do not engage in the sorts of things that Starkey's talking about in terms of the way they speak or the traditions or the, whether it's May Day or any of the other traditions that people have in this country, all of the other little rituals that recognisably make England, England. You have the people, you have the stock of the people, but they carry on living in the in the ashes of civilization with their Netflix and their porn and their terrible weekend television and their Anton Deck and all the rest of it. Is that then the authentic Britain? Right. This is another thing to ask. I don't know. I just don't know the answer to that question. But it is the sort of thing, as someone who feels these things in my bones, I worry about. Because it's possible that you could get the complete kind of ethnic purity that some people want, and you still end up with an end product that still doesn't really resemble the country that I would want it to be. Anyway, I'm going to smoke this cigar and think about this and listen to these two.
A way of cutting this Gordian knot in which we're all tying ourselves.
I think it's
just being muddled.
No, I think it's optimistic, but I don't think it's necessarily desirable. And I don't think it's going to work. And I think what's being offered with that compromise is not between okay and not very preferable. What's being offered is either a sort of South Africa, Lebanon, Yugoslavia style nightmare, because the people that even some of those you're seeking to accommodate will not acquiesce to our demands. Or our country.
Well, we're not making the demands very clearly, are we?
Well,
we're not making any. Sorry, the idea that this is actually being done at the moment is absurd.
I didn't say that.
Of course, it's not being done.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying even your demands, David. I don't think they'll acquiesce to them. Or if they do, it still won't be a recognisable country, and it will have been done without, again, as you agree, the express consent of the people it's been done to. One of the reasons I don't think it's going to work is because we've been speaking about religion.
See, you see, at the risk of sounding like Charlie Downs did at one of his more notorious appearances on television, if you have the bulk of the population who do not actually embody the traditions of the country in any meaningful sense, if they are in effect living as deracinated, globalized, postmodern, inauthentic individuals who have no greater concerns in life than getting Chinese takeaways delivered to them on the eponymous, you know, bike with the Albanian, you know, and all the rest of it. If that is the typical experience or the typical life of most Brits, then what is it that you're asking for these foreign people to integrate into? Because, you know, from a certain point of view, you know, they're not going to, like, they could just do those things as well and just become, you know, everything just becomes this kind of sludge in a way. Because the culture, you know, I mean, let's face it, it's not exactly, there's a world of difference between the England depicted by T.S. Eliot in that essay I mentioned and England as you find it now, embodied in the people who live here. You know, when I walk around the supermarket and, you know, women are wearing their pajamas. So what happens when you get the foreigner who then sees the native Brit wearing their pajamas there and says, well, I'm going to do that as well. That's how I'm going to fit in. I'm just going to, she doesn't care. I don't want to care either. You understand what I'm saying? So I don't know, like, I feel that the problem is spiritual first. Before all other things, it's spiritual first. How do you get people to embody their traditions? How do you get a country to look up instead of looking down? You know, you go out now and everybody's on their mobile phone looking down. Not dressed well, slovenly, not embodying their traditions, living from moment to moment in a hedonistic way. Now, I don't want to sound moralistic. I don't want to sound like I'm kind of on my moral soapbox, but it's like, what do you do if that's a lot of people? What does it mean to integrate into that, David? Because what David's got in mind, people like Rishi Sunak and Rafe from New Culture Forum and people who wear the right suits and say the right things and respect the history. But how many people is that? We're talking like less than a 1% of the population at this point. Or like, you know, with the very best will in the world, 10% of the population at most. It's probably way less than that. So it's like, well, you know, you end up with globalist sludge. Globalist sludge is what all that's left. Anyway, on that cheery note, let's carry on.
As a kind of detached values, proposition-based thing, you know, like cultural identity and that. But I think Bernard Yack done a really good book on this back in 2013 called Nationalism and the Moral Psychology of Community. Nations are lateral and lineal concepts. So you've got the lineal bonds of ancestry, which is ethnicity, families of families, and you've got the lateral bonds of culture and solidarity. And you often, not always, but overwhelmingly often, have to belong to the linear bond in order to share the frame of reference to have the lateral bond. The only exceptions, and you may balk at a biblical reference here, but I actually agree with James Orr of Reform on this, the only exception is modelled by Ruth the Moabite in the Bible, where you get those very rare people who say, you know, your people is my people, your God is my God, I renounce my former tribe and I will marry into your tribe and fight alongside you. And even though they don't become indistinguishable from us, like Ruth is still the Moabite, she's not Ruth the Jew, she becomes one of their kin, one of their countrymen, marries into the tribe. That happens on an organic level, at very small numbers, to the extent to where we can basically name the people from countries where that happens. Like, if every Somalian, for example, was like Ayan Hussey Ali, it would not be like Somalia. And so the extent to which people can be assimilated, not integrated, let's make the distinction, assimilated is very, very small. I'm happy to have those people here. Because, as you said, I think ethnic purity is a mischaracterization of my pursuit. I prefer demographic security. At least, you know, 90 to 95% white British, which is the kind of foundations that we could be flexible with our identity, as you told my friend Carl Benjamin, back when you were boarding, I think it was at Cambridge, and there was a black chap in...
That was the country I grew up in as well, to be fair. And it's no doubt has felt less secure as that's been less the case. So he's right about that.
In your dorms, and you said he was an Englishman, just a shade darker. Let's put it a bit more politically correct, shall we?
My formulation was much cleverer. Yes.
Yes. Well, no, quite. But I don't want the police knocking on my door again. So when we can afford to extend people our consideration as basically one of us when there is a coherent us and that's not under threat. And I the reason I say that we've been talking quite abstractly about religion here is because that will be brought under threat whether or not you try to bring religion to heel. Because we are, as Alan McFarlane has written, a population who have had nuclearized family units. We have had a high degree of inward mobility. We've had completely different diets and dress to the rest of the world. Whereas Patrick Nash, excellent Oxford academic, has documented about 80% of all the marriages throughout all of human history have been cousin marriages. And most of the regions that are the most troublesome, India included, whether they're Sikh or Hindu or Muslim, most of the people that have been imported from those regions are the products of cousin marriage. They think clannishly. In Islam, they have the concept of asabaya. In Hinduism, they have the concept, and this is shared with Islam and Pakistan, of izzat, which is basically face-saving, which is like trying to avoid bringing shame on your family and your clan collectively by just lying, cheating, and stealing to get by. And this happens in small interactions. Like, my taxi driver yesterday took a wrong turn, and he insisted we were in the right place. Indian guy. And it was only because I insisted that he was wrong that he even turned around. This sort of low-trust environment will be built whether or not you bring religion to heel, because this is the sort of the culture, the mindset of people who live in these clan structures and who have for thousands of years. And so even if you try and enculturate them to a cultural identity, you're still going to have them recreating the conditions of their home countries in Southall, in Wembley, you know, spitting pan everywhere and changing the language on the signs. They're going to want to do this organically. You can see this in America in their tech firms, where you get one Indian CEO, he sacks all the staff and replaces them with Indians. You see this, frankly, under the last Conservative government, where Priti Patel described Indian immigrants as living bridges, a term invented by Narendra Modi to describe Indian diasporas as a kind of demographic leverage that India can use to advantage themselves in foreign elections. And then, hey presto, she describes them as this, we get 250,000 Indians every year. The same under Rishi.
This is all factual stuff that Connor's talking here. I don't disagree with what he said here, but, you know, objective observations.
Sunak. When Rishi Sunak was installed as Prime Minister, India celebrates this as the Indian sun rising over the empire. Like, I don't think you're going to abolish this ethnic solidarity, this sense of nationhood, by just trying to bring religions to heel. And so, you know, even if we run our comparatively successful model of public-private distinction, you're still going to get ethnic turmoil, you're still going to get clannishness, and you're not going to get Britain at the end of it, David. And that's what I'm most worried about. Like, I'm, without disclosing anything too personal, like, I am hoping to become a father this year. And that's what I'm most worried about, the world that my kids are going to inherit. This is the thing that Peter Whittle was really worried about. You know, he had no kids of his own, but he was really worried about legacy. And he always used to, in those Trafalgar meetings, accuse the people sat around the table of a profound lack of a sense of urgency. And a lot of what I'm putting forward, a lot of my uncompromising position, is driven by urgency. Because I don't think that we have the time, I don't think we have the political will, and I don't think it's going to work if we seek to accommodate it.
I respect profoundly what you've just said. Now, I too, for obvious reasons, like Peter, am childless. I care, however, profoundly about the thing that I've studied and in other ways experienced all my life, the experience of England and Britain. I differ from you in one fundamental sense. I believe it's stronger than you do. I believe that what has happened is a scandalous and disgraceful failure of our political class as at present constituted to deploy those strengths. I think the historic strengths are there. I believe, and by the way, the reason Restore, I think, is called Restore is deriving directly from my idea of a restoration after the Great Repeal. Yes. I believe that that is possible. I believe that this problem, although it is dreadful, and I would endorse everything that you've said about it, I would largely endorse your diagnosis of it, particularly the terrible problems of cousin marriage and the clannishness that follows from that, that the British state, first the English state and then the British state, set itself so hard, worked so hard to eradicate. But I believe that those extraordinary traditions of this weird country, of its ability to balance change and tradition, of its ability to hold together community and individualism, of localism and literally empire, I think they're still there. I think they're able to be revived.
What is this optimism based on, though? Because I go back to my musing on the maypole and the people that I see around me in supermarkets and in the high streets and all the rest of it, and I don't see much evidence of what Dr. Starkey's talking about, to be honest. The country's changed, even in my own lifetime, beyond recognition. And not, I will need to stress here, not solely in terms of the ethnic makeup of the country. I'm talking about the natives themselves. I'm just talking about the lives of everyday people and the lives that people lead. I don't see much evidence that normal people are in touch with these traditions or a sense of the history of the country or of the things that made the country great. I don't see any evidence of that. I see a lot of evidence that people are just unmoored in a way from all of those things and live in the perpetual present. You know, they were talking about Peter Whittle and Starkey not having kids. I mean, it was, Lord Keynes, wasn't it, who said, in the long run, we're all dead. But in the long run, we're all dead. But what followed from that statement? In the long run, we're all dead, so therefore spend money now, live your life now, have pleasure now, you know, go on the cruise now, enjoy the time while you've got it. And, okay, yeah, people can do that. People do that. But if the form that it takes are all of the trappings of modern life, what is there left at the end of it all? I mean, are we saying that what defines the country is watching EastEnders with the Chinese takeaway? Or, fish and chips or something? I mean, are these things strong enough? You know, cheering on the England football team in a rowdy pub on a Saturday night? Is that it? I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe that is enough. Maybe Starkey's right and all those things make the country strong enough. But I don't know. I sense in my lifetime a degeneration from the cohesive world I grew up in to what I see around me now. I'm just being honest. And, you know, I've got to a place where I'm like, well, what can I do to change this? I might as well, you know, in some sense, try to make the best, and you know, I try to live my best life. And in the end, maybe that's all you can do. If everybody live their best life and everybody try to embody be the change they want to see, maybe it would happen, right? But I don't want to, I also want to be realistic and not engage in, you know, the populist delusion, because that's bottom-up change, you know, and all my whole life's work at this point says the change can only really come from the creative minority, from the elite, you know, from people like Dr. Starkey here. So yeah, I find it slightly worrying if, you know, the answer is ultimately, well, I've got faith in the people, I've got faith in the institutions. Those things, you know, have been failing us. So where's this faith coming from? Where's this optimism coming from? Honest question.
I don't think we need the politics of, and I will throw a word at you, coup, which essentially I think you've been talking about. I think our listeners will be very clear about the differences between our positions.
One final question, please, David.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think those traditions will still be alive if my generation is majority non-British?
No. I am not in the least supine in these matters, as you know. What I'm concerned about is what is...
I mean, I asked the opposite question, and I have been asking the opposite question. What if you get the 100% white Brit nation? Will they still be alive when people of Starkey's generation are dead, or when people of my generation are gone? Who's going to carry the flame? Who's going to keep them alive? Because I don't see a lot of it in evidence in the world around me, is what I'm saying. You know, what traditions? What are you even talking about? You know, I can count on one hand, two hands, the people I know who try to keep these things going, friends of mine. Or people I've met doing this, you know, someone like Survive the Jive or something like that, or Nathan who's trying to restore the castles, or, you know, some of the people in our circles, frankly, who, you know, make a real conscious effort to keep things alive, but they're only a handful of people. And for a tradition to be living and breathing, lots of people need to be engaged in it. And the only thing I see lots of people being engaged in is, frankly, something that you could do in France, or something that you could do in America, or something that you could do in any country. So, you know, I don't want to be too much of a downer here. I'm just in the, you know, I'm practicing radical honesty, which is something that increasingly I talk about on the channel. And that's what worries me. Or do we say, look, traditions change over time, practices change over time, and so the living tradition is whatever the British people do. But then what are you saying? Is the current British tradition takeaways and Deliveroos and Netflix? I'm watching EastEnders. Watching football down the pub. Anyway.
A viable and possible political settlement. I believe in political settlements. One of, again, the great glories of our country is that we have avoided political violence, that we have been able to achieve most extraordinary reconciliations within a continuous political tradition, which I think is something to be immensely proud of. And I think it's still possible. I am not complacent. I haven't sat on my bottom in the past few years either. But that's where we disagree. I believe that the tradition, and again, to end on the personal note, which enabled Roman Catholicism, which, remember, was regarded with at least the hostility of Islam, and was regarded as being as great a threat to the British state, that enabled it to be redigested, reaccommodated, so that became not simply valuable citizens, but led to a very fundamental reappraisal of our history. You know, my own field of history was completely transformed, Connor, in the early 19th century, when we stopped lying to ourselves about what caused the Reformation. And it was the work of great Catholic historians that first pioneered a proper understanding. So I think this tradition, our Anglo-British tradition, is stronger than you think. I think there is a tensile quality about it, but it really has been, and we can end on this, I think, and agree on it, it really has been lions led by donkeys. And the group that need removing are the donkeys. Their brays need to be suppressed. Connor, thank you. And thank you for being so patient and controlled.
I've left this conversation more troubled than I started with it. I smoked this cigar down to the nub. I don't know. I mean, what David is talking about, what would it look like? You know, when I go down into inner London, and it doesn't matter whether the kid is called Ali or Muhammad, or the kid is called, David or James or whatever else, you know, they all speak with this youth accent, white people as well as people of all different colors. And I think to myself, and I've been faced with this situation in my own life. What, I'm going to teach these kids Shakespeare and get youth David and youth Jamal and this other youth to recite Hamlet, and that's going to magically bring about a living tradition? Is that what we're really saying? You know, just get them performing and learning Shakespeare, and get them, get them reading history, and that's enough. I don't know. I don't really know. If I get some young British kid who already, in their heart of hearts, thinks Stormzy is more important than Shakespeare, and I've been faced in a classroom, face to face with young people who genuinely believe that Shakespeare should be replaced on the curriculum with Stormzy. Did my Shakespeare class help keep something alive? Maybe it did. Maybe I was that good a teacher. Or maybe I have been that good a teacher that I was able to awaken something in them. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, is this a losing proposition? Is this a Sisyphean task where you push it up the hill and all it takes is, you know, one wild weekend to undo it all? Did anything stay? I don't know. I honestly don't know. This is, to quote René Guénon, the crisis of the modern world. Crisis of the modern world. So, I don't have a cheery, conclusion. Lots to think about, I guess. Anyway, this was a cheery Saturday, wasn't it? Thank you to Connor and David, both of whom I've met in real life, both of whom are serious thinkers. I like to think I've given people food for thought here. And when you watch this, hopefully I'm out trying to encourage my daughter to live in the real world and do real things and become, you know, British in the best sense and embody the traditions and so on. But I also know that she's going to spend a portion of her Saturday watching videos about Mario, playing Mario Odyssey. And, you know, I know she's got a karate class. Well, that's not a British tradition. That's a Japanese one. But then I think it's good for her to do karate. And I grew up playing Mario. You know, and what I'm saying is these are the genuine things. These are the genuine things that I think about and struggle with. You know, I can't take her to the Maypole every weekend. How much can we keep alive? You know? Should I devote all my time about getting people back into Shakespeare, the national the national poet, study the history plays together, or will it not make a difference at all? Or will it just result in some horrible woke production of Shakespeare at the end of it, where they don't really take anything of the play and bore, they just see themselves reflected in it and their own concerns reflected in it? I don't know. Anyway, pick up a course at the academic agency, promo code COOL, and I'll catch you all next time. I went on a bit longer than I was hoping, but anyway, hope you enjoyed this, guys. Bye all. If you liked this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.